Hey, good day, everybody. Welcome to another great episode of the OIG Roundtable. The band is back. Everybody's back from their first part, or maybe not their second part, or any part of their summer vacation or PTO. We got a great episode for this week. I'm joined by the full group. I've got, of course, my three compadres. Matt Kachansky, retired senior executive from HHS OIG, the retired UPIC Northeast director. Jason Eisengrind, back from his vacation. You're in Alaska, so you're not tan. That's okay. You're wearing mukluks and touching glaciers. Jason, as you know, is retired senior executive, also was Matt's counterpart at HHS OIG, and also Matt's counterpart in the UPIC world by being the Western UPIC director. Wade McFall, or Wade McFowl, depending upon what part of the country you're from, retired assistant special agent in charge from the Los Angeles field office, and now a member of our SIU investigative team. And I did, as always, check my driver's license to see if maybe I got hit on the head and I'm now someone other than who I was born to be. I am still Eric Rubenstein, the senior director of litigation, fraud, waste, and abuse here at Advise. We want to continue talking this week about SIU improvement and SIU process and the like. You know, one of the things that we noticed from talking to a lot of our SIU clients when we're doing process improvement projects, when we're doing training, and even internally, is this whole premise of being able to triage your cases. These aren't pitfalls. Not triaging a case properly isn't necessarily a pitfall. It's an area for improvement. You're not going to, you know, the world is not going to end if you haven't triaged a case properly. What you're going to lose is some time. There's opportunity costs, and it becomes a learning experience. And in the training education world, these become opportunities for improvement and to fix things. Like anything else, process improvement, like compliance plans and like training and education, should be living, breathing documents, and their processes should be living and breathing. And so case triaging really takes a lot of different areas. It is proper vetting of an allegation early on, having some basic foundational metrics and thresholds internally that are reliant upon either internal needs, but also external stakeholders. It's some ability to do some data analytics that are going to provide you with actionable intelligence. I love using that phrase because I think it's true. It's actionable intelligence. And actionable intelligence is data that doesn't lie to you. And the way that you know it doesn't lie to you is because human intelligence works for that. Data by itself is data, and it must be vetted through human intelligence as well. And then the last part is the investigative plan and the living and breathing piece of the investigative plan. So Wade, I want to go to you first because obviously triaging is an important piece of the puzzle. Triaging was, you know, as an agent, you're triaging cases that come in. As the duty agent, you're getting maybe 5 or 10 hotline complaints a day, a week, whatever it may be. As an assistant special agent in charge, a lot of times you're vetting those on behalf of your agents to see, is this something that should be looked at? And even now, as a member of one of our SIU teams, you know, you're dealing with a deluge of things that come in, and where do those priorities fall? So give me sort of, if you had to, not necessarily in order, but, you know, what do you see as kind of the hit list of things that help you make some good determinations on that triaging?
Well, I think probably the main issue, if I wasn't going to put them in order, is to kind of know the overall, I don't know how to put it, but the management approach. What are we looking for? Are we looking for recoveries? Are we looking for referrals to law enforcement? Were we looking for a good combination of both? So when you are triaging these cases, you know kind of which direction you're trying to head in. If it's and it might be different for different companies, you know, government versus corporate world. In the OIG world, Our main goal was to get criminal convictions. So you're looking at all these different referrals that are coming in. You're looking for criminal convictions, number one. Number two probably is civil settlements, again, getting money back. Whereas I think in the corporate world, it's probably a little bit opposite, where it's all about the returns, return on investment, getting money back in to the department or the program. So that, I think that's the main thing, is to know where you're, what direction you need to be going into. And I think the second kind of priority in triaging is to just look at the overall characteristics of the case and try and just cut the fat. Basically, something that's not going to go anywhere, or that's got a lower dollar amount. You have thresholds, whether they're standardized, in the OIG world, we didn't open a lot of cases that were less than $1 million, just because we had so many that were multi-million dollar cases. So if something came in and it was a $50,000 case, it's not going to get opened in Los Angeles. We may have the opportunity to find another venue where it's, if there's a couple Medicare beneficiaries as a part of this referral that are in, Las Vegas or something like that, where we don't have as many cases, I could assign it to someone in Las Vegas and work it that way. So it's really about the getting rid of the cases that aren't going to go anywhere, so you don't just spin your wheels. If agents have, 40 or 50 cases, you end up just trying to touch every case every so often, so it's not getting stagnant, but you're really not making any progress and you're just spinning your wheels. So I think that's really the main things, is to know where the case is going to go, whether it be criminal, civil, or return on investment. And secondly, just making sure you are not working the dog cases that are just taking up time.
Yeah, I mean, you could spend your whole day in Las Vegas watching all of the beneficiaries in their power wheelchairs standing up when they win at the slot machine, doing the happy dance and kind True. Of wonder. But yeah, look, I mean, the takeaway for that is that it's important that from the SIU leadership, that there be some actionable metrics, right? Like, anonymous complaints, for example, of one date of service, that's a quick vetting, where you're talking about one date of service, and it's only one complaint that's out there, maybe that's treated differently than a complainant that is a known complaint. And we talk a lot about known versus unknown complaints. A lot of our training, we talk a lot about how you deal with unknown versus knowns. So yeah, that dollar amount, I think, the big thing they talk in economics, and particularly in healthcare economics, and in SIU management outside of return on investment, is this whole premise in management and finance of opportunity cost. If I'm spending my time investigating and dealing with cases that are unknown complainants or cases that are for $500 or $1,000, the amount of time I'm investing in that is at the cost of the opportunity of the actual return of investment on an actionable case of $1 million. So, or more. So I think the big thing is, it's not just getting management to set what they think are going to be the priorities, but it's getting them to buy in to creating a set of metrics. We're not going to work cases that involve these things. We are going to work cases that involve things. I think I've shared with you guys that at the U.S. Attorney's Office in New Jersey for a period of time, unless there were some plus factors, U.S. Attorney's Office had a blanket declination on ambulance cases. They just didn't want to do them criminally. And for the most part, you weren't even getting them done civilly unless there was some plus factor, five people being put into an ambulance like a clown car. But if there was some issue about, some other factor, they didn't want to get involved in. So you kind of had that as a metric. We weren't going to pursue those. But, that then goes to you, Matt, which is this mm-hmm. whole vetting and data. And, for those of you that have clicked on the link through the newsletter and have watched this before you've read through the newsletter, you'll see that Matt's also written a short blog and provided a little infographic regarding data. And one of my favorite phrases is the data lies, right? It's false positives. And that's a factor in triaging, right, Matt?
Absolutely. Data is the lifeblood of any SIU. I mean, at least half of your cases are coming directly from data analytics that you're doing yourself. Or if you're getting cases from outside sources, your first step is to get the data to see what the damage is. And you have to use that data appropriately and analyze it in a two-tiered fashion before you can really move forward with, putting resources into a case, because data does lie. You can have a data dump come in and it has a provider outside the norm billing something that looks impossible to do, and you're ready to move on that. But what you have to be careful of is that data may lie. It could be that this person is above the norm because they're the only specialist within 100 miles of anybody else. So his numbers are going to be ballooned way above this peer group because, his peer group is spread out and the patients are coming to him because he's the only one available. And that's just one example. There are so many factors you have to look at in terms of why is this person an outlier before you really move forward with it. And the way to do that is continue to use the data, look at other factors. What is their specialty? What is the geographic region? What are some of the codes that they're using and why are they using it? And then even going beyond the data, your first steps in any investigation to help vet and triage this is to think about the data and go get into the provider's mindset. Why are they billing this way? What are some of the possible reasonable explanations as to why this billing is going on? And then you investigate those things, whether it's through interviews, a medical review, a quick one, even an on-site, to see whether or not, why is this PT, billing so many hours in a day? And then you discover, they've got a crew of PT assistants and aides that are assisting them. So that's not an impossible day. And those are things you have to analyze the data beyond just the data numbers on the paper itself. You've got to put concrete evidence behind them to validate whether that data is accurately portraying an anomaly or not. And that's the first step.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, what you're really saying is, and I say this all the time as well, is that the data lies. But I think what it is what we're really talking about are these instances of false positives.
False positives.
And there's two things. The example I always love to give is you're a general ophthalmology practice, right? You're an eye doctor, general practice, and you hire on a retinal specialist. Or a glaucoma specialist. Well, guess what? Retinal specialists, glaucoma, these kind of subspecialties come with a set of skills that require different types of tests, different equipment, different things. Well, guess what? If you didn't do these things beforehand, now you do it. Are you an outlier? Yes. And the problem with the data is that ophthalmologists are seen across their peer group as ophthalmologists. They don't, the payers don't know that you're a retinal specialist when they look at the data, right? Your specialty code is the same whether you're a retinal specialist, a general ophthalmologist, a cataract specialist. It doesn't matter. And so that false positive is going to come, but that false positive comes with an explanation that has to be vetted. I mean, one simple way to vet something like that is maybe you go on the provider's website and they welcome Dr. Kachansky, a retinal specialist. Aha, right? So there are those things. And that's where the data is giving you a false positive, but comes with an explanation. This gets back to the premise of the OIG's 7-point model compliance guidance, where one of the 7 points of the OIG's model compliance guidance is self-audit. If you are looking at your own data, you will see that you have an uptick in certain services, items, and procedures that you previously didn't have, which is going to say, hey, I'm an outlier. Maybe I'm putting myself in a position, but it's an entirely false positive. I mean, the other great example I love to give is in my last year as an OIG agent, when they brought the strike force in to New Jersey, we had gotten a strike force referral on an allegation involving a doctor in North Jersey who was a neurologist and was the number two biller of allergy testing in the country. Now, she wound up having a real problem with that, and there were kickbacks involved, and that was vetted out. She went to trial, she lost, and that was vetted out. But one of the early kind of allegations that the Strikeforce lawyer believed was that there was a kickback arrangement between this doctor and three pharmacies that were all very, very closely located to her practice. It took me one day to realize that that was an absolute false positive. Number one, the three pharmacies were all concentrically located within about a half a mile radius of her office. All of her patients, or most of her patients, were also concentrically located near her office. So it kind of makes sense. Patients are going to a doctor in the community. They're going to pharmacies in the community. By the way, the patients were also of a culture. The doctor was of the same culture. The owners of the pharmacies were all of the same culture. All right, maybe that's a false positive. And if you looked at the drugs that were the top five drugs that were being dispensed from those three pharmacies, they were relatively the same drugs. So what are the chances are that there was actually a kickback arrangement in that regard? I mean, probably not. The data certainly led you to believe that that wasn't the case. It took about a day to do that. So, you know, was there a huge opportunity cost? No. Did the data lie? Well, it gave some false positives on things. At the end of the day, the allergy testing was really what the big problem was. And so, you know, you've got to work through those things. So, you know, Jason, so I want to go to you for this last piece of this, which is that investigative plans are part and parcel to this whole thing. You really can't triage a case, do your data. You have to have a plan. And whether you have a plan, everybody has to have a plan. And as Mike Tyson used to say, everybody's plans go into the trash when you get punched in the face. And that's true. But there are still some kind of standard investigative plans that you can have, which help you triage properly.
Well, one of the things I like most about the podcast that we're doing is that there is a consistent running theme. And the running theme that is part and parcel to this discussion is case management and oversight. I think there is a, and it's just my own personal opinion, of course, but I think there's a misnomer that triage is something that just happens at the very beginning of a situation. So for anyone that's been unlucky enough to go into an ER, for instance, you probably saw a medical professional, probably a nurse, who triaged the situation and assessed, well, what is this going to be and what services should we engage to resolve the situation? And that is absolutely true. But the point is that the situation will become more clear as more facts are known. And at that point, there has to be a reassessment. And so this is a living process throughout the life of a case. And the reason why it is because whether it's a hospital situation, which was the metaphor I was just using, or an SIU, this is a business concept. And the business concept is that there should be a return on investment. And nothing displeases a senior manager, a director, a client, an oversight organization like CMS or anything else, is to have a situation where a lot of dollars and resources are spent on an issue, and at the conclusion of the issue is either totally null and void, or it was something that could have been mitigated with some education resolution much earlier in the process. So that triage, I would, if there's one thing I would like people to take away from this conversation, is an ongoing process. And there should be routine assessments of the status of the case. And again, another running concept that we've focused on several podcasts is prioritization. Where are you going to focus your resources and apply the proper mitigation at the proper time? And so to the point of the data, I'll just say that if data was the be-all and end-all, everything would be resolved through recovery audit contractor type of modality, right? Like you, it would just be like you fell into a certain bucket of and that's the outcome, and here's the bill, please pay it, you know, in 30 days. And what we know is that, somewhat driven by the environment, which is that people are expecting a due process and quote unquote their day in court. So, you know, there are going to be some situations where data can, you know, drive the program integrity process and be the be all and end all of it. But the reality is, program integrity is a layered, multidimensional approach. So data validation is equally important, and that's what an SIU is there to do.
Yeah, I mean, it's an important point. For me, the most important point was the fact that this is kind of a living, breathing process as well. It's a little bit like a compliance plan or a compliance program, right? It's got to be living and breathing. And, you know, one of the most important parts is, as an investigator, and I was probably one of the most guilty, is I was like a dog with a bone. Once I got my hands on something, I just wanted to continue to drive it to the ground to find something. And in some cases, it paid off, because in some cases, I would find that my original allegation didn't pan out, but there was something else. And I remember one case I worked on, it was a QTAM involving an anesthesiologist with something called concurrence. Anesthesiologists need to be during induction and emergence. The MD has to be there during the actual procedure. A certified nurse anesthetist can be there. And this QTAM had to do with whether or not the supervising anesthesiologist was able to be in the same place at the same time. And that turned out to not be a vetted out complaint. That took a little bit of work. But what I did learn along the way is that my bad guy, who the complaint was filed against, the QTAM, was embezzling millions of dollars from his partners. And so there was a whole other case that came about as a result of that. Now, did I spend too much time on the QTAM trying to deal with the concurrence issue? Probably. But part of that was because it's such a complicated issue that it required extra time. So there's always that carve out and that caveat. But, you know, I think as investigators, we hear of an allegation, we want to make sure we're not leaving a stone unturned. But there comes a point where someone has to be the, you know, the referee to say, are you really spending your time appropriately in doing this? And I think that's where you get this, the partnership of an investigator, maybe a senior investigator, someone to mentor a junior person, or someone in a supervisory capacity who can come in and say, you know, let's put the brakes on this, because, by the way, we've got $4 million cases. So this $20,000 case, you know, maybe that's where the more global program integrity piece comes into the picture, right? Treat it as an overpayment, treat it as an educational experience, as a TPE, as we've talked about, targeted probing education. So, you know, this is where the door first opens, triaging cases and seeing where they go is where it starts. And then it's, how does an SIU treat it once it's in the door? You know, are we asking people to take their shoes off, or are we letting them walk around the entrance of our home with their shoes on to see how they behave? I mean, I think that's, you know, what it comes down to. If you guys know, if you've been to my house, your shoes will come off the minute you walk in, because I don't want to give you the opportunity to misbehave. So, you know, and that's clearly a methodology. You know, the minute that you get a complaint in the door, you can go right to it. If you're an SIU that is still kind of growing and expanding, it's a way to develop what those metrics are going to be. So, ongoing conversation. I think we continue to do this. We continue to explore this. You know, when we talk to our SIU partners, we learn a little bit about how they vet their cases, and we find that there is, right, you guys all see this, there is a huge spectrum about what they do and what they don't do. And, you know, one of the things that I know we're working on our internal working group is coming up with some basic metrics that everybody will be on, at least people in our working group, so that they can have a level playing field amongst themselves. So ongoing stuff as always. Great having you guys back for this week. Again, in the newsletter, if you've clicked on our podcast and you haven't scrolled down, you'll see in the newsletter Matt's blog with a little infographic on data and the fact that data, everybody lies to everybody, and the data is no different. It's depending upon whether it's a white lie or if it's, you know, where the bodies are buried kind of a lie. So as always, if you're not getting the newsletter, please sign up. Newsletter, you can get us at hello@advisehealth.com. You can get our weekly podcasts. You can get our recordings of our LinkedIn Live events, YouTube, Spotify, all that is linked into the newsletter. We've got some great LinkedIn Lives planned for the next couple of months, some really good guests. We're going to talk a lot about things in the fraud, waste, abuse, payment integrity world. We're going to talk about hospital bills, as we continue on. We had our LinkedIn Live, I should say, with Eli from $4. We're going to continue on some of those discussions because they are topical and important. So as always, thanks for joining in. Thanks for the support. And we look forward to seeing you on the next podcast.
Thank you all.
Thank you.